Welcome to Eco Living in Action, a half-hour sustainable living show with Maureen Howard. From making your own cleaning products to composting, recycling, keeping chooks and reducing your carbon footprint, Maureen and her guests will inspire you with practical, everyday solutions that make a difference. Eco Living in Action, proudly supported by Sustainable Dunedin City.
And kia ora, welcome to Eco Living in Action on Otago Access Radio, co Maureen Howard Ahal. I'm a sustainable practice educator and communicator based in Dunedin and host of this show. Now, this week on Eco Living in Action, my guest is ecologist Dr. Mike Joy, and our topic is protecting our urban waterways. And we'll be chatting about how academics can contribute to government policy. But on the first segment of this show, I want to talk a little bit about our oceans. The OMV Oil Company's recent proposal to explore for oil and gas off Dunedin's waters has again caused an uproar in our community. Some are in favour of our big oil and gas exploration here, and many are against, wanting to protect our marine wildlife, our beaches, and to stop the worst of climate change. I think that the idea that humans having a large influence on nature is difficult for many of us to get our heads around. For most of the 200,000 years or so that Homo sapiens have existed, we've just played a tiny part in the direction of Mother Nature. But as our impact increases pretty much exponentially, we've suddenly hit that point where we've become really big players. And we're seeing it. Huge areas of the ocean that have become saturated with pieces of plastic, a dramatic decline worldwide in wildlife biomass, and increasing ocean acidification. Now, ocean acidification is the quiet cousin of the result of rapidly putting CO2 into the atmosphere. Our oceans are currently absorbing around 25% of the CO2 from the fossil fuels that we've been burning. In the oceans, the carbon reacts to form carbonic acid, and it's this acid that is increasing the relative acidity of our oceans. Now, off the coast of the west of the US, it's already become enough of a problem that shellfish fisheries are complaining that their juvenile shellfish are finding it hard to grow their form, their shells, in these more alkaline waters. So if you've got family or friends who still doubt that humans are contributing to climate change, you can remind them that ocean acidification by itself is a very good reason for us to leave the car in the garage and to get on a bike or a bus or even into the electric car. Now we'll move on to the main part of our show where I interview a guest each week, and this week my guest is the type of academic that we need a lot more of. Someone who's brave enough to become an advocate for the findings from his academic field. Senior researcher Dr. Mike Joy is a freshwater ecologist and an outspoken advocate for environmental protection. He's currently based in the School of Government at Victoria University in Wellington. For 20 years, Mike Joy has worked on the interface between science and policy, in particular focusing on waterways and their protection. For his advocacy work, he's already received a raft of awards that include an Old Blue from Forest and Bird, the Royal Society of New Zealand Charles Fleming Award for Protection of the New Zealand Environment, the inaugural New Zealand University's Critic and Conscience Award, and last year he was a semi-finalist for the Kiwi Bank New Zealander of the Year. Our interview was recorded on the 26th of April when Mike was in Dunedin to speak at the Wild Dunedin Festival. So Mike, now tell me, what are some of the declines that we're seeing in the species in our waterways? Just briefly.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, we've got some pretty shocking statistics. We've got the highest proportion of threatened freshwater native fish species of any country in the world. About half of the invertebrate species are on the threatened species list as well. So, you know, and I always try to get across to people that the best, you know, I think there's this kind of idea that you go and test a river, like you can stick something in it and measure everything about it. That's about as valid as, you know, going and testing one thing on a human for human health. You can't. There's so many things you can measure, but one or two overall things. So the life that lives in there tells you everything you really need to know. So when you've got three quarters of your native fish on the threatened species list and the highest proportion of the threatened species in the world, then there's a really strong message there that we're in big trouble with freshwaters in New Zealand.
Mm, and it's kind of something that we've ignored, isn't it? You know, we're very aware of our kiwi and other land animals, but in the waterways, it's kind of out of sight a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, but, we have the highest proportion of threatened species over all of any country in the world. So it's not like we've achieved anything. I mean, kiwis and kakapos get lots of airtime. That frustrates the hell out of me because what we end up doing is we look at when species are almost on the verge of extinction, we'll suddenly get up and look after them, and we'll ignore everything else. As a conservationist, as an ecologist, we know full well that the approach to take for conservation is to protect ecosystems, not to protect species. And what DOC does is a purely political approach. And that's for, popularity reasons. They pick on the charismatic megavertebrates, the ones that people will associate with. You know, when they're on the verge of extinction, they'll put all this money into saving them and put them on islands and do all this kind of stuff. Meanwhile, all these other species, 4,000 of them are now on the, or nearly 4,000 are on the threatened species list.
Yeah, I guess it's having a balance of both because we've kind of got to please everybody, don't you?
Yeah, I know. And people won't value... the microbes and things they know nothing about. So, yeah, I see it, but purely, and it comes to, it works for a lot of things. If you just step back a bit and look after the bigger picture, the little ones will get carried along. They'll get picked up along the way. If you try and pick on things, and it's the same when it comes to freshwater quality and greenhouse gas emissions and all that kind of thing, if you just pick on one thing, it'll always look too hard because you won't take into account the multiple benefits you get from higher level decisions. You know, if you keep looking at individual parts of the problem, then it always looks too hard, and it always looks too expensive.
Right, yes, because if you're doing the whole ecosystem, then a whole lot of species benefit
and
the whole thing strengthens.
So you actually end up, on a dollar per species basis, much better off than you if you pick on individual ones. And the same with our bigger issues, climate change, greenhouse gas emissions. If you just look at greenhouse gas emissions, agriculture is a good example where you could have methane inhibitors or you could spend lots of money, trying to get rid of the methane. But if you got rid of the animals or a big chunk of them, then you would fix greenhouse gas emissions, you'd fix the nitrate emissions, you would fix the swimming water quality problems with, swimmability, you would fix a whole lot of human health issues as well. If you look at multiple benefits of a single move, then you can see that it's much better to do that. But we tend, as scientists, we tend to silo things, and governments want to silo things because you have minister of this and minister of that, and so they all take these things individually,
Yeah. So we are kind of aware of the dairy industry. Mm-hmm. It gets a lot of media coverage. And what about urban impacts? We drive along the streets and we put our exhaust fumes and bits of tar and goes into the waterways. What's happening there?
Yeah. I mean, without a doubt, the worst water quality in New Zealand is in urban waterways. But they're less than 1% of the length of all the waterways in New Zealand, whereas in the farming sector, they're more like 45% of our waterways. So, I always think in a triage kind of approach to this that, we got to hit the biggest problems for the biggest amount of rivers first, or lakes and lakes. So that's why I concentrate more on that than the urban stuff. But, yeah, we've got a shocking record for urban as well. The latest figures last year, Water New Zealand study, 152 discharges to waterways of wastewater treatment plants, only 147 of them meet the B standard for, and they've calculated between $1.2 and $2 billion worth of infrastructure work that needs to be done to fix that. And that's our waste, just purely our human waste going into waterways.
Yeah, and although these urban waterways are very small, in a way, I think they're actually really important because it's where we live and it's how we connect with nature and where our children and we can splash around in the water where we should be able to, swim in the water.
Yeah. Now people will be connected much more with urban waterways. But, as a child growing up, as I did in Christchurch, we didn't have local waterways. We went to the Selwyn or the Waimakariri rivers to go swimming, and you know that we went to rivers, but not the urban ones so much. But
here in Dunedin, we've got quite a few.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them are underneath us,
That's underneath the
concrete and the tarmac. But but we've still got quite a few that are out. And so you know. Like, is there people doing research on the urban waterways?
It's a huge research area. And that underwater streams thing, there's been some recent work done in Auckland on what they call daylighting them, which is getting them back out again, you know. And it's incredible. The last one was $1.2 million to daylight 100 metres of stream. So, it's incredibly expensive.
So you see it as an unwise...
Oh, no, I think it's a really wise thing to do, but I'm just saying it's an incredibly expensive thing to do, and they buried them so they could put buildings over them and roads and houses and everything else. And so, getting them back again is no easy task.
Right,
I'd be all for doing it, and we should do, but,
The cost.
Practical.
In terms of the ones that we have, like we often turn them into kind of, they look like drains, don't they?
Yeah, we call them drains too. That's a classic thing that councils do, is to name them a drain, and then you can do anything with them then, you know. It's all semantics, but you can solve the problem. Thinking of those urban streams, there's one in Wellington that a student of mine is working on at the moment, and 90% of it is underground. You know, it's only the very headwaters that are still exposed. And amazingly, there's still life in those streams.
Really?
Yeah,
underneath?
Yeah, not much of it. But, it's a... The our native fish are mostly migratory, and they want to... They'll keep on pushing their way through to get to some habitat eventually. So they're very persistent. And as long as they can get up through these systems, they will. Yeah.
That's amazing. Mm. That's amazing.
Yeah.
We're not giving them a very scenic route, however, are we?
No. Although in some cases, because of climate change and the raised temperatures that happen, because the water that runs off the urban systems, because these are, running off black tar-sealed roads and things, not just the contaminants, but the heating of the water that happens in summertime means that you have hot water almost flowing into these things. So a long shaded, it's in a pipe, it's underground, but at least it's not getting heated up. It has a chance to cool down.
That's right.
So,
and because we don't cover our waterways anymore, there's no foliage.
No, that's right. Because those trees are have an important role of keeping the sun off, keeping them cooler and stopping the algae from growing as well.
Yeah. In our urban environment, I always like to think about, what we can do as individuals and most of us live in an urban environment. Are there any things that come to mind that you think that, we can do to help protect our waterways?
Yeah, well, I mean, I will always say you need to be an activist. You need to be onto the council and complaining and keep, watching what's happening in waterways. I mean, some of the best things that come out of stream care as stream care groups, and it's just because they have people noticing things all the time, and they're onto the council hotline saying, there's some what looks like paint flowing down the stream here, and so being a watchdog is really, really important.
And it's a way to connect with your local community
But I mean, what we really need is for councils to one of the biggest impacts of urban is what we call imperviousness. So it's because we put roads and driveways and houses, and so the water can't get, the rain doesn't hit the land anymore. It hits all this impervious material, and so it's just collected. And so instead of, a rainfall event soaking into the ground and gradually making its way into the waterways, it just runs straight off the urban systems. So you get these massive peaks in the hydrograph, we call it, which is just, extreme flood flows that wouldn't happen naturally because the water has nowhere to soak up, so it goes straight in. Mm-hmm. So we need councils to be strong about making sure that you don't allow driveways that are impervious. You have to use material that water can soak through. You require houses to have water tanks, so water coming off the roof is, at least some of it has been collected. You could then do away with your water reticulation system because houses could collect their own, and that would make, effectively an impervious surface because the water's being captured and not running off. into a stormwater system where it's just.
And you're getting unchlorinated water too, which is a bit better for the garden
exactly.
too.
Yeah, yeah.
But like for you, if we do it, because we have a lot of steep driveways in Dunedin, and I see them, and even just, you know, we can retrofit things a little bit, can't we? And have little, you know, concrete things going across the driveway so that the water gets directed sideways.
Yeah, swales. So, and water capture areas, gardens that capture water and kind of dissipate that flow and let it soak into the ground. Yeah, there's lots you can do.
There is lots. And so slowing it down.
And
in the past, you know, a lot of that water, wouldn't it, would be slowing down and it would have, some of it would have, you know, obviously some of it would have gone into foliage, but some of it would have percolated right down and gone into our groundwater.
Yeah, it would have.
And
now so we cut off all those things. And what we do is we line all those drains. So, you know, a natural stream has lots of connection to groundwater. And so, you know, we call it the hyperaic zone. There's a whole world that lives underneath a stream. A lot of streams, there's more stream under the ground than there is what you see on top.
Right.
And so all of that connection is lost for these concrete lined. I mean, the engineer's job is to get the water out of town as quickly as possible and into the sea so it does, you know, as little damage as possible. But at the same time, they create all these ecological problems because there is no connection. You speed up the flow by doing that and then you get all sorts of damage happening somewhere. Somewhere it's gonna hit.
Yeah. It would be great to see that we can have some kind of requirement every time you make a change or you build, that a certain proportion that we are thinking of that stormwater.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, with all new subdivisions should require, you know, a certain percentage of you know, a limit of impervious surface that you're allowed to put on your land.
Yeah.
We know about 30%. Once a catchment becomes more than 30% impervious area, then the streams had it basically after that point.
Yeah.
So, you know, because of that change in the hydrograph plus all the yucky stuff, all the metals, brake linings, that's another thing that Parliament, you know, central government's looking at the moment is you can, legislate to change the type of brake pads and things that we use in our cars.
Because they're asbestos.
Asbestos and copper and, you know, other things as well. Yeah, other nasties that are in there. Yeah, we could change that.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, talking to you, Mike, I can see that you are quite focused on, you know, about making change. And it's really wonderful to meet a scientist who is focused on that, who's done the research and thought, you know, we want this research to, get maximum benefit out of it, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
So is that what drove you? Like, and has it been a bit of a lonely road?
Yeah, well, it has been. It's been, I think it's got something to do with the fact that I didn't go straight from school to uni and, you know, I had a whole life. I had 18 years working in all sorts of jobs and that combined with anger of seeing how fast, you know, our waterways are declining and the native fish that I started working on were disappearing within years from, you know, places where I'd seen them before. And so that anger's driven me to speak up. But I guess the realisation, and I kind of think, I never know whether it's a naive belief, but that the only way we'll change anything, and governments especially, is they have to have the mandate of the people. So it's no good complaining that, you know, the government didn't do this and the government didn't do that. They won't do anything unless we make them do it. And so, and the reason, you know, I've been working with government in the last year on changes to national policy statement on fresh water, and it's, these decisions are going to come out really, really soon. I've been part of a technical advisory group to the Minister of the Environment, David Parker. He's going to have this really tough decision about how tough to be about protecting fresh water. And he has the mandate now to do that. You know, there's these polls recently saying 80% of New Zealanders think it's the most important issue. Mm. So now he has the mandate to be strong. And that's about education. It's about people realising there's a problem.
Yeah.
The next hurdle is going to be climate change. And it's the same thing if we... Any government that made the tough decisions we need around climate change is going to get kicked out. And the only reason is because people don't understand. If they knew the extent of the problem, then they would have no problem with the government making the changes. So I think the key to all of this is public education, public understanding of the problem. And then then we can have governments make the right decisions.
It certainly is. That's right. So do you see that, are there good avenues? As a scientist, have you found quite clear avenues to be able to get involved in policy change?
Yeah, well, I mean, this change of government's obviously been at, I've been so critical of the Ministry for the Environment for at least a decade and a half now. And now I'm in there every other day working with them. So this, there has been a definite change in, you know, on multiple working groups. So there's that kind of political toing and froing that happens with change of government. But I also think that I've realised the importance of speaking to the public and using media, using, you know, writing op-eds and articles. I mean, you know, when I compare... there's a thing called ResearchGate that scientists use, where we put a lot of our research so that it's available to, mostly to other scientists. And there was an announcement the other day, I've been on it for at least 15 years, that I'd had 8,000, you know, it was a, they try to keep you in there. So congratulations, you've had 8,000 reads, you know. Oh, and then an article that I wrote with Michael Baker from Otago School of Medicine on the freshwater impacts and the nitrate and the link with cancer and drinking water, that we published in the Conversation just a couple of months ago, it had 50,000 reads within a week. You know, so when I think about what I published in you know, learned journals and things, you know, you'd be lucky, even with a good one. One of my best ones got 200 citations, but most of them would have half a dozen or 20. A whole bunch of academic papers will probably never be read by anyone except the editors, you know. So there's this game where we're paid the PBRF, the performance-based review funding that academics are, you know, have to survive on, live or die on, basically, or their jobs do, is all about publishing in peer-reviewed journals, you know. And it's a funny academic game. I'm really, really more and more frustrated
about what a game it is. It's not about influencing the public. It's more about, well, I guess research is, you need to build on each other's work, don't you? So someone is going to read it if they're doing their research.
What happens is, though, that, and I see this, that you just look at the game is now to get, you have 100 authors on a paper, you know, because everyone wants to get... It just drives all these weird unexpected outcomes that. And it pushes academics to write lots of silly little papers rather than, you know, because it's about volume, you know. And so if we just published one really good paper in 5 years, which is how it used to be, you know, that would be fantastic. But now they want 5 a year, so you're going to just try and put, you know, as much as you can into volume. There's all these reasons why why it's nuts.
So I guess you feel that the work that you're doing, you know, to influence policy and to communicate with the media and do talks and everything, feels a bit more immediate and worthwhile.
I just totally believe that we won't change until people understand the problems.
So what would be your vision then for New Zealand if we could somehow make everything all better?
Oh, well, I would, there would be no more monocultures, you know, so no more paddocks of ryegrass, you know, stretching across forever. Get trees back onto hills again. All the steep country should have trees on it. And I'm no fan of pine trees, but a mixture of things, but we really need to lock up a lot more carbon up there. And that would protect those upper catchments and stop all the sedimentation, which is another huge issue for our rivers. Estuaries and lakes, you know, is what comes down those rivers, plus taking carbon with it as well. So really diverse farm landscapes that are way more like permaculture than monoculture. And that would make them so much more attractive places to be, and you wouldn't have to bring in, you know, desperate workers from overseas to work on our farms like we do at the moment, because they're such inhospitable places that, and the, you know, the wages are so bad. We could get into a situation where those are beautiful landscapes, and they could be part of tourism as well, because, you know, instead of just acres of flat grass, you'd have, and with pivot irrigators, you would have trees, and, you know, you would have nuts and fruit and bees and, you know, you name it. There's so many things, you know, nice ways of producing food that aren't industrial like we have at the moment.
That's right, and it's and in a way it makes its own kind of ecosystem.
And the rivers will be so much healthier, and the people will be healthier. There is another upside to it is that it brings community back. You can't do that, you know, that permaculture, that multiple land use stuff with one person can't. You know, one person can be a dairy farmer or a sheep farmer, but one person can't do all the skills that are needed, you know, across a really diverse system like that. So communities come back again.
Right.
Come back into their own, yeah.
Sounds a great vision.
Okay.
Thank you very, very much, Mike. Can people look at any of your, your op-eds? If they look out for Mike Joy, I'm sure they can just
there's a Dr. Mike Joy page on Facebook where I share a lot of stuff. And there's watercualitynz.info. So all one word, watercualitynz.info. And I've got heaps and heaps of information on there as well.
Great. Well, all the best. Thank you very much for coming to the show. And thank you for listening. This is Eco Living in Action, and I'm Maureen Howard. And today I've been chatting with Mike Joy about our waterways and how we can make them clean in the urban environment. If you'd like to listen to the show again, you can download it as a podcast from the Otago Access Radio website at oar.org.nz. Thank you for listening. Eco Living in Action is supported by Sustainable Dunedin City.
Sustainable Dunedin City aims to facilitate a positive, secure and sustainable future for Dunedin. We're local people interested in issues of climate change, declining energy security and sustainability. Is their effect our city? Sustainable Dunedin City produces a regular online newsletter of sustainability related events, hosts regular green drink sessions and organises the Big Green Challenge. For more information or to join, go to sustainabledunedincity.org.nz.
They tried to make me go to rehab, I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab, I won't go.